Hey, it's Sam Alai here, founder of My Legal Academy, where we help lawyers scale and automate their law firms so they could sign up more clients and reclaim their precious time. If you're looking to grow your practice while working less, click the link in the show notes to book a free call to discover a radically different way to grow your law firm. Enjoy the episode.
The billable hour doesn't have to be a prison sentence. While most women in law are trapped in a cycle of burnout and sacrifice, there's a revolutionary approach that transforms billable hours from a burden into a strategic asset. Today, we're exploring how to build a profitable, scalable law firm without sacrificing your life on the altar of time tracking. This isn't about abandoning the billable hour entirely. It's about mastering it instead of letting it master you. Join me and my guest, Emily Logan Stedman, who, as a commercial litigation attorney, turned her personal struggle with big law anxiety into a platform advocating for lawyer well-being. All right. Welcome, Emily. I'm super excited to have you today. Funny little thing I have to tell you is prior to our conversation and scheduling, I had a complete opposite take on our conversation today, a complete different set of questions. I was literally going against everything that we talked about, and I had to flip everything on its head from just the 10 minutes that we spoke. So I'm excited to have this conversation.
Awesome. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. So why don't you start with just kind of giving us a little bit about who you are and your journey and where you are right now.
Awesome. So I'm Emily. I'm a commercial litigator and partner at Hosh Blackwell, which is based in St. Louis, and I work in the Milwaukee office. I was born and raised in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia, sort of checked all the boxes, went to college, did Teach for America, went to law school, ended up moving to Milwaukee to clerk after law school, and I've now been here 12 years in June. And the end of this week is my 9-year anniversary in private practice, which is crazy to think about.
And I think, what was the time frame since you made partner?
I have been partner 1 year and 4 months.
Wow, that's so exciting. Was that like a huge shift for you from just that role?
Yeah, yes and no. So in a lot of ways, the work doesn't change, right? I still have matters where I'm sort of the senior associate-esque attorney on the file, managing it and running it day to day. But I also have the first big, big piece of litigation that I'm running day in and day out, and I get to make all the decisions on, which is equal parts exciting and terrifying. And then there's a little bit less pressure with the billable hour. I say a little bit because I still need to track and bill 2,400 hours a year as a partner, but the mix of the time I track is a lot more flexible. So I have time to build a business, which is something I really enjoy doing.
I love that. So thinking about the billable hour, which honestly, I feel like when most people talk about it, when I was talking about it, because I didn't have your take on it, was that it's archaic, that it's, you know, the old way, it's been around for decades, and people are trying to figure out how to stop doing that for various reasons. But like, for you, was there like a breaking point for you where with like traditional approach and making you realize that it's broken in its format and the way people think about it versus the actual billable hour being broken?
Sure. So people bash the billable hour. There's a lot of valid reasons to do that. I've been in private practice 9 years. They've been talking about getting rid of the billable hour that whole time. It has not gone anywhere. My firm is very progressive in thinking about alternative fee arrangements and working with clients to come up with other ways to invoice for the time spent on the matter. But even on alternative fee arrangements, the attorneys still have to bill their time. And so probably around my 3rd year of being an associate, I realized, one, the billable hour isn't going anywhere. And two, I otherwise really like my job. So maybe there's some way I can adjust my attitude about the billable hour and manage it in a way that becomes almost a non-issue. Like, it's like what I tell people is it's like clocking in and out. I wouldn't love clocking in and out, right? And tracking my time like that 40 hours every week, but I would do it if it was required. And so that's how I view the billable hour. It's just part of my job. And flipping it on its head that way has really helped me not carry the burden of the billable hour as some other people do.
Do you think it's like your firm being, you know, aggressive and being willing to make changes? And because I think we still do hear some people that are, you know, in big corporate firms freaking out about it and it being such a pressure cooker environment. So I wonder if it's where you are, what you're doing. I'm not sure. What is your take on that?
So I actually started thinking differently about it at my prior firm. And I mean, if you're in a big firm like I am, my firm just hit number 78 in the Am Law 100, the billable hour is a thing, right? And you know it going in. No one hides it. You don't join a big firm thinking you're not going to have a billable hour requirement. And so there is that pressure to hit your hours, but I think you can be eyes wide open about it. And so for associates, you have to know and understand the consequences for not hitting your hours. And for some people, that's okay. They don't care as much about a raise or a bonus. And so if they come in under, they come in under. Other people are really motivated by the monetary consequences, the benefits of hitting their hours. So it can go both ways. But I think what happens is attorneys are high achievers. Attorneys are type A, most attorneys. Attorneys want to meet their goals, but the billable hour is not intuitive. It is not natural to track everything you do in 0.6 increments, in tenths of an hour. It is not natural to review your activities every day and then try to summarize them in a way that a client will pay for. But it's a skill you can learn, and you can then use it as a metric to better manage your time and hit all of your goals. There's a whole bunch of skills that go along with hitting your goals. But if you make a habit and routine, and if you systemize it very early on, it can truly stop being this dead weight you carry with you every week and every month and every year.
I think I start to question too with, you know, working with as many female lawyers as I have, when they're questioning, you know, not paying themselves, or they're questioning lack of profit. And then when we look at, well, the structure of how they're being paid, being contract, being whatever it is, you start to question then, you're not tracking, you don't really know, how did you come up with these numbers? And so is it quite possible that if you were tracking, you'd realize that you're not charging enough?
Yeah, I think it all goes hand in hand. So all time management experts, if you read just about any book on time management, they tell you to do a time audit. They tell you to bill your time, essentially, to track your time. So what I tell associates, and in my mind, I have this class that I teach at law schools teaching law students how to be a big law associate. And it will entail them tracking everything they do day in and day out, no matter what it is. And that's what I tell associates at the firm. If you're doing something that anyone at the firm would deem part of your job, if you're doing something that anyone at the firm would be glad someone at the firm is doing, you track that time and you enter it into the system. And that's essentially showing your work. And so I've had instances where maybe I just crossed the threshold of my billable hour requirement, or I exceeded my hours, but a big bill didn't get paid before my year ended. But the firm can still see everything I've done and everything I'm doing. And so I'm rewarded for that.
So what do you think then? Let's just leave it at it's inevitable, right? Like billable hours not going anywhere. And then on the flip side of that, actually, even if you're not doing that version, having to track your time and understand what's being billed, what's being retained, and what your profit is, what do you think would be the biggest mindset shift that has to be made across the board in order for the weight that this is, that the billable hour carries?
One, I think you have to really understand the purpose of the billable hour. It is how we get paid. It's how partners get paid. It's how the firm makes money. It's a business. And it is truly to show your value on a matter. And I think if you shift to think about that, think about it that way, rather than, you know, it's just a chore I have to do and there are these deadlines and if I don't do it, I'll get fined. And you think about it as a tool for your business, your small piece of business within a larger firm or your entire firm for yourself. It can help you start changing your mindset. Also, if you think about it as showing your work. So particularly with big law associates, I talk a lot about how a firm will take from you. It'll take from you your time, your energy, your effort, take, as much as you allow it to. But you can take in return. You can take experiences and opportunity and skills that make you marketable. And ultimately, your billable time or your investment time, your professional time that you're tracking, show what you're worth. And that really helps me rethink it. The other thing I think is making it part of your routine. So every attorney has habits and routines and systems that they use. And if you break it down into a daily habit, it's just such a lighter lift. It's so much easier to track your time in real time every day and enter your time every day than once a week or once a month have to spend hours looking back and taking a guess at what you did and when you did it.
I think part of that goes into thinking when we talk about the mindset of it being like the enemy of work-life balance. Like there's no possible way to have a relationship with this, you know, billable hour and be, you know, understanding that, you know, and I think also when you're saying like my value is tied into it, I think that can be sort of a mindset issue for some people, especially if you don't, you know, I'm not meeting the numbers, so my value isn't there. So how do you, you know, suggest, I guess, both between the work-life balance and then also understanding not mixing that value together?
Yes. By value, I mean value for myself. I have worked very hard to separate my identity from my billable hour numbers and instead view them as my hard work and how I'm gathering skills and experiences. And yes, it matters to my firm and it makes money for my firm and it protects my clients. But ultimately, it's important to me to show that work and use it as a tool to truly see how hard I'm working and use it as an example of how hard I'm working. On the work-life balance, I think the quintessential example that people use is that you don't really get PTO in big law. If you take a vacation, you have to make up your hours elsewhere. Absolutely true. But you can take your billable hour goal and map it out over a year, block off days you're going to take vacation, and then make monthly, weekly, and daily billable goals so you account for that time. Also, by tracking daily and entering your time daily and comparing it against your goals, you're very easily able to see when you're caught up on your hours and when you're ahead. And I'm a huge advocate of looking at that, comparing it against your to-do list. And if there are no emergencies, walk away. Take a nap, go to Target, go to the spa, hug your children, whatever it is. And that's how I take back some of the autonomy. You know, I haven't really found a phrase I love enough to replace work-life balance. Instead, I think about autonomy. People feel like there at the beck and call of the billable hour, at the beck and call of clients, the court, the partners you're working with, your family, your children. One way to start building a greater sense of autonomy and control is to exercise that over the billable hour instead of it controlling you.
I like that, because I was going to ask you like a tactical question on like the approaches that you've used that you've found to maximize that, maximizing both the hours that you're working, you know, making sure that you hit your time. But I love the reverse engineering, the vacations and the, because I'm a very like strategic that way. So once we start with the year, then we go by quarter, then we go by month. And I think that you breaking it out that way, even for me, who is just kind of learning on the back end of this, how this works, that makes total sense. And it's very easy and it's easy to see. I think the bigger part is, and I think that maybe you can speak on this, like how long did it take you to be able to just then walk away? Because that's easy to say, but then like, okay, what do I do now? Like I have a million things I could do, but walking away is like the hardest one.
It's the hardest and I still struggle with it. And I still struggle with guilt and feeling like I should be on, but technically you're still on, right? Like I have my phone. If they don't get me by email, the people that are important have my cell phone number. They know how to get in touch with me. It probably took me at least a year to really walk away, but I was lucky. When I started at my first firm, an associate who was a year or two ahead of me gave me this advice. She said, take advantage of the slow times. So one of the hardest things about a legal practice is how much it can ebb and flow. It can be chaos, all hands on deck, and then a full-blown drought. And when you're in the chaotic times, you're going to wish you had taken advantage of the slower times. And so I try to remember that. I also am constantly looking at my to-do list and prioritizing and asking myself, what can wait? And you get over time really good at knowing what the real emergencies are and what the fake emergencies are. And the more you ask yourself, what can wait? What is a real emergency? The better you get at sensing when you can walk away. And this can even apply when you're working full days, but you want to take a break for dinner, you know, at night. And you'll learn to have a sense of, okay, tonight's a night I don't need to be compulsively checking my email, right? There's just not anything brewing behind the scenes, or something's brewing. I better be checking my email. And you learn to kind of sense those things over time.
So tying that into then, so we talked about kind of how that ties into, you know, you physically looking at the hours and how you manage. How does that tie into, I want to talk about client expectations and then your team expectations, because I know from my own personal experience as the client expectation side, we have demanding expectations. Obviously, I think everybody does. We feel like we're paying, so I'm demanding. But then on the other side, obviously, knowing that every time somebody's speaking to you, there's cost involved in it. So how have you been able to, you know, I think I want to say balance is not a good word, but balance it so that they're still receiving the kind of service they want while you're still balancing yourself and your well-being, because not everything is an emergency, but we always feel like what we have to say is an emergency. So what's the balance with client expectations? Or do you find that that's not as big of a thing because they know they're being billed?
You know, I think the pandemic changed a lot. I think coming out of the pandemic, everyone's working all sorts of off-schedule hours, day in and day out. My clients are all over the country, so we're in different time zones as well. And so I like to use the phrase reasonably available. I am known for being very responsive, and it's that reputation that honestly allows me to take a little bit more guilt-free advantage of the slow times, because unless I'm like truly on an offline vacation, I'll be responding to my emails or looking at them once every 8 to 10 hours, right? Accounting for nighttime and when I go to sleep. So I think if there's this myth that if you, you know, step away, and I fall into this where I think They're going to be looking for me. Oh my God, if I don't respond to this email immediately. But like 9 out of 10 clients and partners are not looking for you. They're not wondering where you are and what you're doing. So some of it is just self-talk you have to get over, and then clearly communicating with your clients. So I haven't yet had to have a conversation with a client about, like, I'm very serious about sleep. And so I will be offline these hours of night to morning. Like, so for example, I go to bed very early, but I'm also up very early. So I can catch people's late night emails in the morning. You can communicate that with your clients. I also think a simple, hey, got your email, I'll get back to you in the next 24 hours is incredibly helpful. I believe in using your out of office message. If I'm going to be out a half a day or more, I put up my out of office message saying when the next time I'll be responding to messages is. And that's client service. That's teaching your clients what to expect. And that's what I expect from my teammates. You know, I can't always expect it from the partners who are senior to me, but I try to model for my associates what I expect. And that is upfront communication. You know, I tell them, you never have to work on a weekend for me unless I explicitly ask you to. Now, if you want to, good on you, but that's not the expectation from me unless I ask explicitly. 2, if you're going to be out, let me know. Like, if you're going to be out in a way that disrupts kind of like our normal flow and what we're used to, just tell me. And I think so many of the problems and mistakes and road bumps I hit as an associate could have been avoided just by having a little clearer and more communication amongst the team. And I pride myself on not expecting everyone to behave like me and giving them room to be themselves as long as that communication is free-flowing.
I think that that's something that needs to be kind of talked about more, because I think we talk about, like, you know, lawyers being burnt out and their well-being, but then I think we forget that if they're burnt out and they're stressed and they're just can't handle it, the entire team is probably feeling that same exact pressure and, you know, burnout, and it's not useful for anyone. But I think that you're right. I think there's not a lot of direction on, you know, what do I do as, you know, a team member, as someone who's assisting you, that can balance, you know, client expectations with your expectations, with also still, you know, serving myself in that role. So I think it's a huge gap, probably, you know, they just throw you in and say, figure it out. And
they do.
That doesn't always work.
No, and attorneys are managers. Even if you're a solo practitioner, if you have an assistant, if you have a paralegal, you're managing them. We're managing our clients in a lot of ways. We're managing down to partners junior to us. We're managing up to attorneys senior to us, attorneys junior to me. There are no partners junior to me at this point, but few attorneys know how to manage. And I've been fortunate to have life experiences that have taught me how to manage other people, including my peers. Like, people have strong opinions about Greek life and being in a sorority, but being in leadership in my sorority and being editor-in-chief of the law journal taught me so much about managing my peers. And if you can manage your peers, you can manage just about anybody else. But part of being a good manager is having some self-awareness and having that free-flowing communication.
Yeah, I think the biggest misconception that I think even I had to learn a few years ago was that when you come in, I had this expectation that lawyers just, they know everything about their business. They know everything about running a business. They know everything about leading a team. And it's so not true, because it's not what you're taught. So when you come in and be like, this experience, rather, you know, somebody says it's funny or not, like, there are certain life experiences that if you don't have them and they're not teaching you how to lead, that is not a skill that you're just going to automatically have for the most part. So I think that, you know, having more of that, having that be more talked about and it being okay, because I think that's also a thing where I'm a type A, I can do it all. I'm just going to say I do it all.
And there's very few people that are willing to admit, okay, I'm the bottleneck, I'm the problem. Now what do we do?
Yeah. It's got to be talked about more. And we have to seek out, if our firms aren't offering us training on this, we have to seek it out. You know, I've read books about managing. I've read books about the business of the law. Because also, when you're thinking about associates, as you progress towards partnership, the billable hour matters as a metric, but you also have to start showing an interest in and an acumen for the business of the law. And I taught myself most of that until I hired a business development coach to really help me. And it's okay to say you don't have those skills. I think that's one of the biggest problems in our profession is a lot of us are afraid to admit what we don't know. And I think it's a real strength. It can be really brave to say, look, that's not my skill. And that's not what I'm interested in doing long term. And I've been fortunate to be pushed a little bit into admitting some of those things myself.
I mean, I think that's great because I think first of all, I don't think that there's enough women speaking about other women having that. I think we as women, when we're speaking to each other, we have that ability more to say, you know, hey, listen, this is what's happening. I don't think that's the case when we're, you know, with our male counterparts. It's a little bit more, they're not doing it, so I'm not going to do it. So it's a little, you know, more scary. And that's like a whole nother level of a conversation. But I think the more that it's talked about, the more that it's okay that, you know, this is why we hire people or, you know, I don't want to do this. I've had quite a few attorneys come and say, I don't want to, you know, practice law anymore. I want to learn how to run my firm. I want to be the CEO. And I've had some say, I want no part of that. I just want to love what I do with being a lawyer. I want to go to court and I don't want to deal with that. And I'm like, this is the first good thing that you said, because you know where to go. Now we have a plan on how to get there. But when you're wishy-washy and in the middle, it doesn't work. And then on top of that, when we think about the billable hour and then just revenue in general, I think that's where people start to get extremely burnt out.
Yes. And I mean, I think it's easy as a human, but it's especially easy in the legal profession to just start moving through your career and checking boxes and doing as you're told without ever asking yourself, well, like, what do I actually want my career to look like? And it's so important to ask yourself that, because if what you're doing is what you want to be doing, you can go out and get more of it. And if it's not, you can have that real reckoning moment of, okay, I want to make a change. How do I do that? That's not easy. I've been through that a couple of times. I'm going through that now as partner because I truly love, and this has really surprised me, love the idea of building my business and being like the CEO. Like when I'm in the four walls of my office, it's the law firm of Emily Steadman within Hush Blackwell. And I get so much joy out of that. And, you know, it's a long-term plan, and I have to balance the need for billable work against it. But at least I have an idea of what I'm going after.
I love that, though. I think that's a great way to look at it. I think even for like associates or even for, you know, the paralegal teams that we've dealt with, it's like, this is your little, you know, universe of what you're doing and where you want it to go. And to think about it that way, I think would be a huge mindset shift for everyone. With that, I think, what, if any, because obviously we have a huge technology shift coming and every day it's changing, but how has it helped you or hindered like the efficiency of billable hour being profitable? I think that there's so much out there and so many things you can do and so many people just talking about just have AI do it. And I'm curious how that plays into the billable hour.
Yes. So on the one hand, for the billable hour itself, I don't use a ton of tech. Like I've never been able to figure out the timers. I don't really have a good timing where we enter our time. Doesn't yet perfectly capture what I'm doing all day. So I might say I've billed 10 hours and it'll say I've billed 2, or I might say I've billed 10 hours and it'll say I've tracked 15. So it varies wildly. But on generative AI, I use it every day. I started experimenting with it for content creation and ideation, and really around panels I was either on or moderating and having it create questions for panelists. And then over time, my firm has its own generative AI internal, so all like privilege is protected. And Thomson Reuters now has co-counsel, which I've started using. And it makes me incredibly efficient. And I do see ways where there are some one-off research tasks that I normally would have given to an associate that I'm just running through co-counsel, getting the answer and moving along much faster. About 6 months ago, I did some discovery requests and I talked with our generative AI about what type of case it was and what I was looking for, and had it generate topics for interrogatories and categories of documents for requests for documents. And it took me 0.6 of an hour to draft these discovery requests that probably would have taken 2 had I just done it my own, at least all in with the back and forth drafting. But I think where generative AI is a crutch is particularly at smaller firms where they maybe don't have the framework and institutionalized processes and procedures and training. Particularly in litigation, we're seeing people use ChatGPT as Google. And if you hear anything from me about AI, it is that AI is not Google. It's more like a first-year associate, and you have to coach it and train it and trust it, but verify all of its answers. I feel like we have a real ethical obligation to learn and use it, but also to verify everything.
Yeah, I think that when you think about it on that aspect, but also think about it on the aspect of, like you said, with time, something that could have taken you 2 hours normally and now took, you know, 0.6, that's a both a benefit for you, for your headspace and your time in managing the things that you have to get done, as well as the client, if it's not taking you 4 hours to do something that you can get done in an hour. So I think the benefits are definitely there, but I do also, like you said, see drawbacks in people wanting to have that be the thing that is the answer to the, you know, everything. But foundationally, this is where we go back to the business issues again. Like, AI is not going to fix your business issues. If your foundation is not set, you know, you can't build a house. It's going to fall down. So
it's like a legal assistant. It's not an attorney, right?
Yes. Well, even I think even, you know, because we do a lot of AI, we have a proprietary program coming out next, since Intake AI. And so we do a lot with it, but I also see a lot of misunderstanding on how to use it, what to use it for, why it should be used, and how it can help save time in the comfortableness even of, I don't really want to use AI from that comfortable, and trying to bring people into to say, what's some of the basic things? Like, you're spending 5 hours in your email. Well, that's something it can help with. Like, those are like the starting points, because I think it's, number one, it's tech, and number two, it's scary. And people are like, I just, don't give me one more thing I have to learn how to do.
Yeah, that's all fair. And we were talking earlier about mindset. I feel like the best mindset you can have with it is almost like playful, like trial and error. Find something not work related and just experiment with it. And this is another thing coming back to management. You really have to manage it. Like, I give it a lot of instructions.
Yes.
And I tell it to ask me questions one at a time until it has enough understanding to answer the question. So you really have to coach it. I've been taking classes on Coursera. Vanderbilt University has courses directed towards attorneys, but also just prompting and ChatGPT generally. And they've been incredibly helpful.
Wow. Yeah, because I think you're right. I think beyond, you know, trying to teach people that you have to train it initially so that it understands you, what you do, who your client is, I think that understanding, and I think maybe that's why more, you know, attorneys don't use it as much, is because they're like, I don't have the time to sit there and have it, you know, I have to ask it 14 questions and then I have to go through 13 iterations. And I'm like, that's the way that it works, but it still saves time. So I think that that's That's something I think is totally a thing.
Yeah. And it's just like that first time you give a research project to an associate, the more you spend up front telling them how to do it and what you expect, the more time you save at the end.
I agree. So I always like to end with like a few really tactical like strategies that we can give women. So for women who feel that they're trapped by the current billable hour, or maybe just trapped in general by, you know, fees and costs and not understanding that part of it, what can they do in their billing model? Obviously, if you work for, you know, a large firm like yourself, their billing model is probably one you have to comply with, and you know, you can't change that. Or even if they have their own solo practice where they're able to modify their billing model, like what's the first step that you would recommend that they take?
That's a good question. I think the first step is to know the goal. So that's told to you if you're in a big firm. If you're in your own firm or a smaller firm, you might have to come up with one. Know what your goal is and then break it down into smaller, manageable chunks and make it your own. Like truly take ownership of it as a business person, as a businesswoman. And find a system and a daily habit that works for you that you almost no longer have to think about the billable hour because it just becomes routine.
I think that's great. And I think I like using like the term of just, this is kind of my philosophy for everything, but just be rebellious against what you think you have to do and what you actually want to do and what works for you. Because I see far too many people trying to do the same thing that Emily does, but this works for you. This is what you've figured out. And it might take some time to figure out what works for you and what feels the best. But copying someone else, I've always found, is never usually the way to go. You know, you can have a starting point and a framework, but figure out, you know, how to make it work for you. And like, I can't do time blocking. The people that talk about just block your time and don't do anything. And I'm like, that does not work for me. Like, it makes it worse and it actually gives me more anxiety than it does anything else. So I'm like, that doesn't work. I can't do that. So when people come to me and say time blocking doesn't work, I actually appreciate the fact that it probably doesn't for them. And so like, what can we do to that can work? Because I can't shove it down your throat. It's not going to work.
Right. Yeah, that's what I tell everyone. Like, I'm here with tips and tricks. Take them. What works for you, take it, run with it, make it your own. If it doesn't work for you, throw it in the trash. The point is to experiment until you have the thing that works for you.
I agree. So let's just play that we've got things working. Everything's great. What would you say would be like the number one warning sign that a woman should watch out for to realize that the relationship with the billable hour or the billing in general is becoming unhealthy?
It's almost like counting calories. Like if you try to stop and it's all you're thinking about, it's a problem. And I've been there, and sometimes that comes and goes, and it takes a lot of work, and sometimes it's daily effort. But I know I'm in a good headspace when, like this weekend, I can just go with the flow, work if I want, work if I don't work if I don't want to, and I'm not calculating like, oh, that nap was 1.2 and this dog walk was 0.4. So that, and the other thing I would say is, one thing I think women do more than men and younger attorneys do more often is discounting your time. When you're tracking your time, you should bill every last thing. Like, and when I say bill, I mean input in the system. You might write it off when you send it, before you send it to the client, but don't discount your time. That's hurting you. It's hurting your bottom line. It's not showing the client how much potentially it was actually required to do the task they asked for. So really fight the urge to discount your time.
I think too, when it comes to time tracking, this was something that it was probably a month or so ago, I actually did for myself, not because I wanted to, but because it was part of something I was working on. And I'm like, okay, it's very difficult. You're right. Like every time you changed a task, and for me, who's, you know, kind of OCD, I would do multiple things at the same time. I'm like, oh my God, I'm switching back and forth. And there was a lot of, you know, like 0.5, 0.1, maybe I spent an hour. And I'm like, holy cow, I did that for a week. And a lot of things came out of it, rather other than just
you know, realizing, like you said, like for clients and what you're billing, like there was a lot of things I realized I should not be doing. Like, this is why you have an assistant. This is why you're doing things you shouldn't be doing. There's things that I should have been delegating. There's things that were just, you know, distractions that I don't know how that they creep in. And then there is those things like, why at the end of the day am I exhausted? Well, when I looked, I don't eat. I barely got up to use the restroom. And I'm like, okay. Like, there's a lot of other things about tracking your time. So I would say, even if you aren't in a place where like the billable hour is a must for you, even if you're a legal assistant or I would say try it for a week. You would be shocked, I think, at the amount of things that you find out about yourself, about what you're doing, and about the things that you can change if you just try it.
Yep, absolutely. A time audit, all the time management experts say it's worthwhile.
It's scary, though. Once you do it, you're like, oh, Lord. Yeah. So one last question for that. But I think for women understanding, especially new attorneys coming in that are coming into this setting, understanding like really what's possible for them when they master the billable hour, instead of number one, listening to the noise everywhere. And then number two, allowing it to kind of master them.
Yeah. I mean, that just brings back really big memories about my first 2 years as an associate, getting to maybe the last quarter of the year, realizing I was behind and having to go out and find more work than was probably reasonable for me to take on to hit my hours target. It's not fun for anyone. It's not a great place to be. So when you take control of the billable hour and you track it meticulously, the number one thing I hear from associates when they report back that they've implemented my system or a version of it that's their own is, I've hit my goal every month. I'm on target for the first time every month. And that is such a weight lifted, right? Because you know where you stand. And when you fall behind on month four, it's much easier to go out and proactively get that work. So you're not trying to bill 300 hours in month 12. And no one, I've yet to hear from a friend at a firm that how the firm taught them to bill their time is how they do it. So you really, truly have to go out and learn this on your own and make it your own, because most people who are training you on it, most people who are 20 years ahead of you are doing it the way it's always been done and not the way that makes it less burdensome. So don't be afraid to seek out others who can teach you how to master it.
Yeah, I think that's a big, being strategic about everything. And I actually think that when you're saying it, you're actually teaching them in a way to understand, you know, if they have to ever, you know, run a business, run a project. I mean, these things are important, how to manage it, how to know when you're hitting your goals, how to manage it, you know, another person if you're helping manage their KPIs. I mean, there's a lot to be learned inside it that I don't think people realize. It kind of just feels like something I have to do. But I think if you take a look at it the way you're looking at it, in the sense of, I'm learning something about the process, I'm learning something about myself, I'm learning something about, you know, the entire aspect of what we do, I think it's huge. I think that's a big mindset shift, even for somebody who just wants to track your time to see what happens. I think you'll start out with that instead of starting out with what I did, which was like, why do I have to do this? I probably would have found even more that I did on the level that I, you know, tracked.
Yeah. The other thing I would tell associates to do, I did not look at an actual bill that went out to a client until I was probably a sixth or seventh year associate. I should have looked at one much, much sooner. It is extremely helpful to see how the time looks on a bill and how everyone else's time around your time looks. It'll put it all in a whole new perspective. So if you are on a matter or you have a mentor that you can ask to look at a bill, and you'll have a real world example of what it looks like, and it'll put it all into perspective.
I love that. That's a great, I think, final to leave that on. But I would also say, I would challenge everyone who's listening, women, to identify, you know, one aspect of their relationship with the billable hour or with your billing in general and see how you can transform it. Because for me coming into this, like I said in the beginning, I had a complete different take on the billable hour and what I was going to talk about and how, you know, we need to get rid of the old school stuff and do the new things. And, you know, everybody, not everybody wants to be a lifestyle lawyer. Not everybody wants to be, like you said, that lawyer that hits all the bonuses and all the things and makes all the money. There is everything in between.
Absolutely.
So I was really educated on this topic, even though I like to challenge all the things. I think there's still a way to do that, but without having to just throw everything in the trash.
Yes. I mean, I like to say I'm challenging the way it's always been done while making it work until it changes.
I love it. I love that. I appreciate coming on, Emily. And I know that we have lots more to talk about, and I'll have you back on for sure with other conversations that we touched on before. But thank you again so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Law Entrepreneur. If you found value in the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And don't forget to share the episode with a friend. It could help transform their life. To get access to a treasure trove of exclusive free resources for lawyers, go to joinlawyerclub.com. Again, that's joinlawyerclub.com. We'll see you on the next episode.